we all can come up with great concepts, constructs, frameworks, processes, and ultimately what makes one client really successful and another client fail is our ability and the client's willingness to adopt change, which is the hardest human endeavor.
Welcome to the Leaders of B2B podcast, a weekly show where we bring you interviews and in-the-weeds expertise with today's B2B experts and thought leaders. You can see more about today's episode and guest by visiting our website at leadersofb2b.com.
Hey, leaders, welcome back. This is Ledge. Today, I'm talking to Mike Smart. First of all, you can't go wrong with a name like that when you're a consultant. I mean, you know, right away, just I want to talk to the smart guy. So, you know, now I am. So, Mike, love if you would give an introduction of yourself and your work. You and I met on a sales call, actually. And, you know, I was just like, this guy has to come talk to me. So I think we're going to have fun today. So please say hello, introduce yourself to the audience about yourself and your work.
Brian, first of all, thanks for inviting me on. I felt equally strong about the energy between us. So I'm looking forward to having a great conversation today. Again, Mike Smart, I was introduced, but I am co-founder and managing partner of a focused consultancy called Eager Solutions. And we help mid-market B2B software companies and SaaS companies accelerate growth and market success through product management.
When you talk about product, people talk a lot about product marketing, product-led growth, technology-based solutions. Are we talking all tech here and SaaS? Are we talking physical, actual products that people can touch? All the above?
Great question. So I started this consultancy in 2009, and in that 15 years, we've touched all things tech. Some biotech, not a lot. We don't have enough PhDs in science in the background to do that. A lot of commercial software, B2B software, enterprise software, some health device companies, some health tech companies as well. So where we like to say we are best and we are strong is in areas in which software is either the primary target product that people are consuming or it is the primary enabler to generating revenue. So we've also touched fintech as well.
Yeah, it's interesting because I work primarily in B2B services, if you will. But I always say, you know, it's sort of tech-enabled services, right? Like everything is running on this SaaS, you know, sort of spider web. It's like making 100 million things easier to use and talk to each other and passing data around. I mean, we just like the cloud is real, man. And it's like everything we do. I was talking to somebody about getting a new, you know, work computer, which one you like. It doesn't matter. My whole world runs in Chrome, like all of it. Every single thing I do, I just need a browser running machine now and I can pull it up on any device. And I think like the nature of product in that sense has evolved so much. You've got upstream, you've got downstream, like you don't build all the things, you build your piece and it plugs into an ecosystem. I mean, there's so much there.
The interesting thing about that is, if I think back to 2009 or 2010, when companies were building platforms, solo platforms, all encompassing, the shift has completely rotated. There are a few beneficiaries of building platforms, and we can all rattle them off and name them, right? They're on one hand, and everyone else in the space is plugging into those platforms in some manner or occasion. The old school term we used to use was system of record, meaning that your platform, if you are at Salesforce, Oracle, Microsoft in some instantiation, Google in some instantiation, Apple, then you are the system of record. And everyone else is a system of execution that plugs into you. So what really becomes important is how fluid and how easily and how well you understand the work stream of your users. You have to plug into that. You can't disrupt them. Your tolerance or my tolerance, we were talking about this before we came on the air, for lack of connectivity, for behaviors that get strange inside your platform as Chrome, is absolutely down to zero, right? I'm not going to change my work stream to use your product. I'm not going to change what my job is to have success with your particular implementation of how I do my work.
That's interesting. Yeah, I used to do way back too long ago, you know, right around, gosh, like turn of the century now, which is funny to say because it makes it sound like you're
old, man.
Absolutely. And that shift to everything had to be on a new ERP and everything had to work together because there just wasn't this idea that there was open APIs and web services and all these things. And I think the major shift in that, you know, was really Amazon throwing down the gauntlet and kind of just saying, Jeff Bezos credited with saying, everything we do will be run as a service. And then that's the nature of Amazon Web Services. They ate their dog food first, and then they made that thing available to everybody. And then I think the rest is history. But I can remember when that first turned up and people were just like, wow, this is insane. And it continues to be this just absolute monster.
Well, what you point out with Amazon is sort of the, I think, probably the most complete success story, if you will, because others tried and others went before them, was this ability to understand that the work that we do effectively can, almost everything we do can be automated, right? I mean, high percentages. And as a result, if you build systems the right way, if you ask the right questions of users, if you stay user-centric, you can build capabilities that people can actually see and see the benefit of without having to, I used to call it, invert their mind to kind of just get on your platform. And there was a time when, you know, you logged into a piece of software and you couldn't understand what it was supposed to do, and you went to training classes for it, and you still didn't understand what it was supposed to do when you finished, but you had this job to do, and somehow these things meshed together. And I think Amazon pushed the envelope on that really hard and obviously had great success with
it. You just described the circumstance I had this weekend when one of my daughters was trying to show me Snapchat, but I digress.
Well, that's the other part of it, is that because we live on this edge of innovation, right? There is always a generational gap created. Once you and I master the platform of our youth or our prime, there's something else that comes along and you look at it and you go, I don't get it. And the one for me right now is TikTok. I see it, I watch it, but it's like, okay, so I'm not getting this. And you know, and there are people that are a lot younger than me that go, what do you mean you're not getting it? What is there not to get? You just get on it and do it. And that's the exciting thing, I think, about this business, that things are always going to be changing.
You mentioned product marketing, which is going to be both post-design and an iterative fashion, obviously, because user feedback, UX, customer discovery, you know, so all these things, like, they ought to be looping, right? Changes happen. And no idea survives first contact with users and customers. And then even beyond that, in my work working on complex sales, you find that it matters that I have users who care and like the thing, but none of those users are empowered to write a check to buy the thing. So then right. I have, you know, multiple stakeholders that I'm trying to say, it's cool that you like using it, but if you don't tell your boss and show why it's worth it with me, we're never going to get this through the next budget meeting. So, I mean, how do you address when a company is building a product, you know, that has that kind of reach? I've got lots of users. Users are happy, maybe. But then there's all the other stakeholders in a big organization that need to pay for it or okay it and all these things. I know from a sales perspective, we lean into product marketing to help us and enable us in that way. And I've been in orgs where they don't do that. I've been in orgs where, you know, it is in fact collaborative top to bottom. And I'm just curious for your perspectives on that.
So if you've worked in organizations where it's been collaborative and it's effective, you know what good looks like, right? I mean,
I know what good feels like. I get to close deals.
Exactly. I mean, look or feel or both, you reap the benefit of it because you're able to move with a lot more velocity to close business. And so the product marketing dynamic, which I think has become in the last, let's say, 5 years, maybe a little more, centerpiece of this whole dynamic of creating product out of whole cloth technology, innovating and then moving it through. Because the shift has gone from, I mean, we were putting the layers down for this. We have a high expectation of the performance of technology. All of us, everyone on the planet has a high expectation, and we might thank iPhones for that, a high expectation of the way things plug together and integrate. And so suddenly now, as you look into the space that I live in, which is principally B2B, those people who are users are also users of iPhones and other smartphone devices, and they're not going to check their brain at the door when they come to work to use a system that sits back 10 years. So now suddenly the user population is much more, shall we say, sophisticated, to use just kind of use a basic term, and their expectations are much higher. So it's harder to convince them to, again, we're back to changing what their job is, changing how they do their work, to change their work if the capability doesn't accelerate them or give them something that's personally beneficial. At the same time, in a B2B space especially, there's been a lot of research and a lot of data from Gartner and others because of this thing we were joking about before we came on the air called the internet. Buyers are about 70%, most people say, some people say 80% completed with their purchase decision before you as a salesperson ever walk in a door. And so with those two dynamics, high expectations of users and a buying group, whether it's highly placed individuals in an organization or a buying committee, 70% complete with the formation of what they think they need and the options out there, the sales role has shifted massively, right? So you can't come in and just give them basic information. You've got to come in and understand how to communicate with them with where they are. And so that puts a high burden on go-to-market. It puts a high burden on product marketers to understand buyers and users in a way that you as a salesperson can communicate the strengths and benefits of your capability compared to others, the cost benefit of it. You mentioned before, get a lot of users interested in using this thing, but there's no cost justification. There's no ROI in it for the buyer. And now you suddenly stall, hey, this is a cool tool. This is a great technology. I love it. It's got great, great UX, and I'm having a great time using it, but no, I don't have any budget. And if you're a salesperson, that's a non-starter. So how do we build? So product marketing's role is to build that momentum around the business case. What does it do for the buyer? What does it do for the organization? And how do everybody, this stakeholder group, collectively benefit from making this change or adopting this capability?
I think, you know, I'll see if I can extend your iPhone metaphor, because what I think often gets missed there is what I'll call that total package experience, right? So ever since Apple started shipping the iPhone in an absolutely gorgeous box, let's just ignore the fact that like an entire forest dies for every one of these things.
That's a different podcast interview, right?
Right. Different stakeholders, I guess. But every consumer electronic product, every consumer product up the ante on like this thing needs to be a gorgeous unboxing experience. And when I think of B2B and the multiple touch points, that unboxing experience, is it easy to deal with my finance team? Is it easy to deal with my account services team? You know, is the CX really, or the UX like extends into all the touch points? So if I see a company that's like, it's an awesome product, but it just sucks to deal with them in every turn, that I think is like, you know, your sort of gorgeous iPhone being shipped in a garbage bag. That would be a very different experience. And so what I encourage businesses to think about in that total experience of dealing with you, do you want to be the department that is the garbage bag that's preventing somebody from even thinking there's a beautiful iPhone in there?
I love the analogy, and I think it works because that is something that smartphone manufacturers, Apple, started this, and it extends to their whole approach toward user experience, which goes all the way back to Macintosh laptops and other things, right? That they've always been about that. But the other side of it is specific to the B2B environment you're sort of laying the foundation for, is every single thing that we put into a product, if it does not create a sense of value and reinforce the decision, is destroying the relationship with the vendor. That's the way I think about it. Yeah. And that's also the way I communicate it. If you're not creating and reinforcing the decision that, hey, this is high value, and it can mean all sorts of things. So take your packaging metaphor and explode it in the B2B environment. If the adoption of a capability, let's take, for example, an applicant tracking system. Just if the adoption of that system requires some segment of the user team to go to hours and hours of traditional training, whether it be distributed online or self-help, you are delaying their confirmation that they made a good choice. If the requirements, I'm using the word intentionally, required to start adopting and using this require meetings, constant meetings with the IT staff, and require a project manager, you are destroying the decision that they made in terms of how they view it. That, to me, is the packaging, right? It's the life after the deal closed. You're the salesperson. You close the deal. You inked it. It's a six-figure contract. You feel good about it. And 60 days later, your customer is still slogging around trying to figure out what to do with this capability you sold them. It's just an unacceptable and untenable position today.
I'm laughing so I don't cry, but yes, I've been in that situation. Or just like, I can't believe that you, my dear colleagues, screwed this up so badly after, you know, the blood, sweat, and tears of bringing that deal in. And that happened. You know, I get it.
And so the work that needs to be done today, we just talked about the laying the groundwork. Users are empowered. Mm-hmm. Buyers are doing their own research. The expectations are high because of, we thank Amazon, we thank iPhone, Apple via iPhone, of the packaging and the integration and the seamless UX. Mm-hmm. The bar is really high. And so the emphasis in my client base is mid-market B2B companies, SaaS, implemented SaaS, is to stop the emphasis and the overemphasis on building new stuff. I was going to use an expletive, but I'll leave it out for right now. Stop building new shit and focus on the things that you've built and make it easier for people to adopt.
Which is adoption is the 90% of retention. And then just the fact that it's so much more expensive to bring on a net new customer than it is to just do a banging job and keep and grow, land and expand. You know, we love that in sales, right? Like, just you're dealing with companies that are big enough that we can get more seats in other departments and internal recommendations. And I will say that that extends far beyond the sort of standard package, because is it a problem for your company to just deal well with the people who pay the bills at procurement or at finance? And is everything you do just a pain for the other people? Because those influences matter. And every touch point matters. And so I think if we miss anything thinking about product marketing, is that it misses that context, that we are a service organization even when we have product.
And so then the real hard question for engineers, product managers, product marketers, and mostly executives to get their head around, when do we start thinking about these things that you and I are talking about? And it has to be at the very beginning of the development cycle. It has to be at the ideation stage. When you sit down and start drawing up the new widget, whatever it is, the people at the table who sell it, like yourself, the people at the table who are responsible for marketing it and messaging have to show up, and we have to think full cycle at the beginning so that as much as possible can be designed in by the engineering team, that product managers can capture user input and buyer input about what priority those things need to be in and how important they are. And then product marketing can extract those things, relate to what buyer needs and buyer pains exist, and help sales convert into messaging that they can use in front of the buyers and the users. If you tack it on at the end, you've missed something. You've missed a lot.
And I'll tell you, from the standpoint of having been in organizations where, you know, product marketing had the last say so on, like, here's your sales deck, here's the way you're going to present this, you can only say these things, it hamstrings that sales process. Mm-hmm. Because marketing is designed intentionally with good purpose to attract the average persona. You can totally nail the average persona, but here's the problem. Like, while Mike Smart is a component of the average, he's still Mike Smart, and I need to talk to Mike Smart and understand his thing. And if I'm pitching a bunch of your canned messaging at him because you made me do it, I can't ask, I can't be inquisitive, I can't discover and build a relationship with that individual who's just a component of that average persona. And I empathize with everyone who has to do that job of saying appeal to all who are in the fit and then appeal to one who is part of the fit. And I think that that relational component is what can often get lost when we go scale, scale, scale as fast as possible, do things and whatever. What's the whole, you know, move fast and break shit. But it's like that might work in a massive scale consumer lock-in endeavor. If you're Apple, you can do whatever you want with your software, evidenced by all kinds of behaviors that you may or may not appreciate in the marketplace. But you can't do that in a B2B context.
If you're $100 million or even a $300 million B2B provider, you have to do the extraordinary work to understand your buyers and your users better than Apple ever would need to. Absolutely right. And you have to spend more time and more energy and effort building out adoption capabilities, onboards and onboarding and on-ramps for them to ease into your capability, because you're not Apple and they're not going to put up with the things that you and I know Apple have done to us over the years that we said, well, that's Apple, we'll put up with it, because there are too many other options out there if you're not Apple.
Right, right. Yeah. What do you see? So you're talking, you know, we're talking a lot about product and positioning and marketing and like sort of like tactical hands-on types of things. What do you see from organizational human perspective? It's like, I know that, and I'm sure you have worked in a lot of this is change management. Like you're going to come in and in order to achieve those end results that we're talking about, what you're really talking about is moving a lot of humans. Like 80% of the work is we need to change behaviors, and we might even need to change the way that we work together, because if we ever did it wrong, that's the combination of that collaborative infrastructure that's just screwed up. So what do you see on the people side that can be imparted to the B2B leaders? Because that's who we're talking to.
So you hit on, I think, the most difficult thing of anybody who calls himself a serious consultant, because we all can come up with great concepts, constructs, frameworks, processes, and ultimately what makes one client really successful and another client fail is our ability and the client's willingness to adopt change, right? Which is the hardest human endeavor. So one of the things that I say to, and I have had great success by speaking truth to power, and I've been, as they say, kicked to the curb by speaking truth to power. But I continue to do that because I think if I have any integrity at all, that's the one thing I can bring in the door for an engagement. And one of the things that I have learned is that when the executive team, the ELT, is curious, has confidence in themselves, and really, really interested in seeing the organization expand and grow. I mean, from a heartfelt space, they care about the people, that these kinds of topics and conversations have a very different tone and a very different directional tone and very different outcomes than if they're not. And what that means is I may come in with grand schemes. Consultants do that, right? How do I maximize the engagement so that we can see? So not just about the fees and all of that. I'm talking about so that we can maximize the engagement so we can show demonstrable outcome.
Hold on. He said not just to maximize the fees. I just want to make sure everybody heard that.
I would happily talk about the way I set up fee structure, because it actually defies the notion that some consultants out there, and I'll name names, like the largest ones, McKinsey and Bain, structure their fees. I do things on a fixed price basis most of the time, and for that reason. But it's about maximizing the outcome. It's about having the great story to tell. And so when we confront reality, which is our client, we find that their appetite for risk is going to be different. And so we adjust based on that. And over the years, what I've come to accept, Ledge, is that small changes are good. The notion, the James Clear book, Atomic Habits, resonates with me, because I have, in my own personal life, found that making small, committed, repeatable changes can have a massive outcome when you roll them up. So I have sort of turned my practice on that sort of principle to say, let's not come in and try and, we're not going to blow up your organization. That's just impractical. It's not even a good idea, even if you could succeed in doing it. Let's take changes that we can sustain. We may stretch some people. We may ask them to do things somewhat differently, but what we want them to do is commit to doing these things over a long haul. Mm-hmm. They'll feel better about themselves. They'll see results. The organization will see sort of the magic of change happening without it being a strain. And that makes this actually work. So to your point about change management, my growth path and my maturity path is that small changes are more effective and more sustainable than big changes. That takes a different perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. I experienced that message in a personal development sort of workshop that I, you know, went through. And the example that they gave, I may be flubbing this, but it was something along the lines of, if I leave San Francisco and there's a 2% deviation, just a 2% change, and I travel across the country, I'm either in Boston, New York, right? And ultimately, at the end of that journey, what we're looking for is a sustainable trajectory to get, instead of to A, get to B. But I don't just shift the wheel all at the same time, because humans don't work that way.
What that requires is a different mindset than how, and you and I are probably close to the same generational place, how we have been trained and educated. We have been trained to set up things and understand how they work and then set them and forget them. And the world doesn't work that way. We have come to understand, in part through the use of technology and other things, that everything is iteration, right? That we find that our own human body works that way. If you eat a donut at 9 o'clock in the morning and follow it up by a large, extra large pizza at noon, by the evening, your body is behaving very differently than if you had an apple in the morning and a salad at lunch. And so we understand that reaction and chain reactions to thing are how we react. And then we have to know, what do we do? So if I ate the donut at 9 and a large pizza at noon, in order to have my body sort of like not go crazy on me, what should I be eating next, right? Not to continue the thing. So the same thing, the same kind of feedback exists in business. If we built this thing, this great widget, this great capability, and we're 7 months into it and only two people have bought it, what do we need to go back and think about and do differently? That's the iteration part of it. Well, as a product manager or a product leader, I need to come to you, Ledge, if you're the person out there selling. What are they saying to you? What are you hearing? Why aren't they buying it? How did you sell the two that you sold? What did they see? And I have to rethink now, what are my messages? And maybe I did make a mistake in designing. I don't hide that. I open up about it and I say, you know what? We thought X and it turned out to be X minus one. It wasn't a disaster, but we need to make some adjustments. And that's the process that we live in this environment, especially in business.
So that's a good segue, because you were talking about some personal development or learning exercises. You mentioned off mic that for the, what, fourth or fifth time, and I've done the same thing, you picked up and started going through Think and Grow Rich, Napoleon Hill, you know, classic. It's the kind of book, I think it's like Lean Startup, like everybody has it on the shelf and like 90% of people haven't read it, but you know, you just need to feel smart and have bought that book. I have read through that, like, waded through that book to the end about four or five times. It's thick. Sometimes I don't love it, but it has that concept of slow and deliberate change. And I wonder what you're experiencing in that now, having your back into this. And there's a lot of ideas of sort of stuff that way before The Secret or Manifest Your Truth. And there's all kinds of weird things where you kind of go like, my mind to create my reality. So I just wonder where you come down on that. It's not at all the tactical consultant mindset that we're taught in quasi-MBA, right?
Right. No, exactly. No. And so that's a layered question. I'll try and answer it if I can remember all the pieces you asked, because it's really important. And one of the things that I am learning, and I am a lifetime learner, I told my kids who are now out of college, you go to college to learn how to learn. Whatever you study, you'll forget it. It's probably not going to be useful. But if you spend those 3 or 4 years of learning how to learn, mission accomplished. So that allows people who do that, and I consider myself one of those. I learned how to learn at that in that environment, and it's not the only way that people learn it other ways. Then I have the facility to go through life and correct mistakes that I've made. I've made a lot. I talked about iteration, course correct when data that I'm getting from life is different than what I expected. And so what is amazing about that book to me is that it was written almost 100 years ago, and it's still relevant. You hit on the secret. There are threads. And you said, oh, well, this read, I'm going, oh, this is in essence what The Secret is about. And it was written 65 or 70 years before The Secret was ever conceived of. And as part of the broader spectrum, I think that we in business, and this is not the way I was educated in my MBA program, it was not the way I was taught in undergraduate school, is that there are dynamics out there in our environment that cannot be well explained in terms of data and analytics. And in the old school world, we used to call them instincts. And somehow we fell away from that and we fell in love with data and analytics. And what we're learning is that data and analytics, and I'm also a big sports fan, so you know that data analytics have taken over the sports world. And I watched two NFL coaches get fired at the end of the season because they were living off of data analytics. So somebody goes 4th and 4 in the third quarter down by 3, and instead of kicking a field goal, they go for it on 4th and 4, and the team loses the game and they get bounced out of the playoffs. Or somebody kicks a 60-yard field goal because analytically, the field goal kicker in the last 6 times during practice has nailed it. And during the pressure with 85,000 people in the stands, he can't. And so those kind of instinctual, non-analytical, non-data things, I think, have a place in our lives and have a place in business as well. So I'm back in reading this book, and it's interesting you hit on this, Ledge, because that's sort of what I'm picking out of it more than anything else, is the presence of things that are hard to explain, that are hard to understand from the classical business training that we have. And I'm just kind of going through them and just accepting them. And I'm sort of paging through my own experience and saying, yep, that's an example of that. Yes, that one actually happened to me. Yes, that's another example of it. So I'm enjoying this journey through this book. It is about my 4th or 5th time through. And you and I were joking about the workbook, which I had years ago, and I can't find it now, that I went through and filled out all the forms on it, right? That's not what I'm doing this time. I'm just enjoying the journey through the book. And it's sort of to come back with, okay, I got some of this right. I did some of it right. Some of it I need to course correct back to that lifetime learning. And some of it is still an opportunity because I didn't get this out of the book the last time I read it.
I have to joke at myself on the workbook. The first page of this workbook is that you have to take, there's just a blank thing and you're supposed to fill in what is the amount of money that I'm going to base the rest of this on, right? I have never once been able to look at that thing and put a value in there. Thus, I have never turned to page 2. So I don't know what that says about me, but I suspect that it has something to do with this idea that the bigger thoughts of the book are what resonate with me, not the idea that I must, in fact, now do the activities to commit myself to, you know, make X dollars.
And I think, and so this is where, and there are things in there that are dated and they're time dependent. Yeah. I mean, I've had people jump up and say to me, that book is misogynistic because it was written in the 1920s and the early 30s or mid-30s, the society was misogynistic. So yes, the author is a product of the environment. And you could continue and go down a lot of streams with that. And I'd say it's like reading anything else that's historical and classic. It has parts of it that are dated. To your point about the dollar amount, you're not the only one. I sat and looked at that and struggled. And I put in a number. I remember this. I put in a number and went 3 pages in and came back and erased it and put in another number and then came back and erased it and took that test too big and took it down. I think we all struggle with that. And so I think part of that is, to me, it's understanding the context and understanding the point. The point is to get you to focus on what's called a definite purpose, right? It is your, what we today call our why, right? Simon Sinek has made tens of millions of dollars recasting definite purpose as a why. I'm a fan and a lover of Simon Sinek, but he's taken Definite Purpose and modernized it and packaged it in a way that we now can accept it. And that's all it was. And if you put it in context, the country and probably half of the world in the 1930s was coming out of a depression. Yeah. So of course everybody was focused about how much money they're at because the currency had collapsed, because banks had collapsed. So it's like, put it in context and now update it, roll it forward and make it work for you. So today I don't put in a number, but I do have an idea about why am I continuing to do this? I'm at that point where people say, well, how long are you going to do this? And I say, I don't know. I have unfinished business and I'm not done yet. And that's my purpose. And it doesn't have anything to do with money per se.
Right. Absolutely. Well said. Well, before we get stuck and jammed up against the top of the hour here, I would love to know the unique perspective of a consultant as you get to have a lot of different experiences. You're not just with one, you know, organization. So many times you can assimilate, you know, sort of a bunch of different stories and look for maybe meta trends. But what should be on every listener's radar going forward? We have, you know, all kinds of sea changes and just the pace of change. But what are you seeing? You're working and so you kind of go, I really, really think everybody should be paying attention to this. And maybe they aren't.
And I've had on my podcast, which is GTM Disrupted, had someone say this, and I thought it was really insightful. So I can't claim this as my insight. So we need to start thinking about how we use AI to improve the lives of our customers, not just how we sort of come up with a use case that gets our investors satisfied. So really spend the energy, time understanding the problems that our customers face. I would take that to the next step and say, if it's not AI, if you're in a service delivery business, if you're a consultant, if we start with the premise that most, and we said this earlier, we're talking about Amazon, most things that people do, they can be automated in some way, shape, or form. And so if I were a consultant in a different field, accounting, I would start thinking about how does automation, whether it's AI or not, affect what I do as an accountant? Or if I were a consultant to law firms, how does technology impact what I do to consult to my lawyer clients or their clients? And I think thinking that through, thinking about the work stream is critical. And I believe that some people are grappling with this. And I'm not saying think about it and then come up with a solution. I'm saying talk about it, think about it, iterate on it, spend cycles with it, and try and deeply understand this. And I think that puts, if you don't do anything specific to automation, it puts you in a better understanding as a consultant to have a much more relevant, value-based conversation with your potential client. That's one. The other one, you hit on it earlier, it's the whole change management dynamic, is that we live in this time of massive sea changes. And I don't think that's, it's not going to go back to the way it was 5 years ago. Nothing's going backwards. And so if we think this is fast and we think change is absolutely coming at rapid speed, it's only going to continue to do that. So the most important thing, which is why I'm rereading that book for the fifth time, and I'm reading some other books along the same idea, and I'm taking more threads from the Atomic Habits sort of concept, is that maintaining my being feet of fleet, being flexible, being able to pivot, being able to rotate, even being able to ask myself really hard questions about what is my value proposition to my clients, really hard in the mirror kind of questions, and be willing to massage and change things based on, I think, is a critical path for everybody. If you're in business, I think you have to constantly keep asking yourself that and keep pushing yourself and pushing your teams to do that.
Fantastic wrap. I love that. Very, very inspiring. I want to get off the phone and go do some of that work right now.
That's my next hour, as a matter of fact.
I wish I did. I'm staring down Zoom until 5 p.m. today, as usual. But there will be time made. There will be time made. Mike, I love the conversation. Thank you, you know, for the insights. Thank you for joining us. Anybody out there who's resonating with what you said or wants to know more, what are the channels that are best to reach you on?
So LinkedIn, for sure. Michael Smart on LinkedIn. You can find me there. I have a podcast where I've kind of broached some of the subjects that you've talked about, we've talked about today. And it has a bend toward B2B and technology. And I interview people that are executives and leaders of companies and ask very similar questions of kind of what we're doing. They are the source of my information. They are the source of my knowledge. So I'd encourage somebody to hear it from the raw source, and it's GTM Disrupted, and it's on any podcast platform you can find, GTM Disrupted. And what else? My website, egresssolutions.net. Those are the places you can reach out to me. Happy to interact. Favor, if you come through LinkedIn, let me know that you heard it through this podcast, and then I understand the context for it. That would be helpful.
Fantastic. Well, Mike, again, thank you so much. I love the conversation, and we look forward to pushing it out.
All right. Glad it was great to meet you. It was great to have this conversation, and you have a great rest of your day. Take care.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Leaders of B2B podcast. And as always, you can see more information about this episode and all the resources mentioned at leadersofb2b.com. If you enjoyed the show, please give us a 5-star rating. This episode is brought to you by Content Allies. We help B2B companies launch revenue-generating podcasts. We schedule interviews between you and your ideal prospects and strategic partners. You show up for engaging conversations. We handle everything else. Ready to build a podcast that grows your business in just 1 hour per week? Reach out to us at contentallies.com.